said at the time of going to bring out that we were just getting each group to discuss one of the topics. I hope it didn't disappoint too much that you didn't have the opportunity on the other one. However, you will have an opportunity now because we're going to have a brief report back from the staff members in each of the groups, and then we will open it up for a discussion on topics for any additional comments. So should we start off with the liabilities equity? Manuel and Peter closest. Manuel, do you want to go first?
Yes, sir. Our group had an interesting discussion on the equity, as there was. There were a few themes that came out of our discussion, I think, and feel free to correct me if there's any thoughts that. But I think there was a lot of concern about the complexity with these instruments, and when we start to get into the details of distinguishing complex instruments between liabilities and equity, it can get quite difficult and quite confusing for users to understand what's going on. Both the settlement and narrow equity approaches, people view them as a bit more intuitive and a bit simpler to understand. The value approach was a bit more complex, and it wasn't immediately intuitive to people. However, having said that, there were some concerns about the outcomes of both the settlement type of approach and the narrow equity approach. On the settlement approach, there was concerns about having a debt that settled the shares, where you would require a cash outflow regardless at some point in time in order to acquire those shares, or in order to or basically looking at it as two transactions being compressed together. On the narrow equity approach, there were some concerns about a lot of equity-like instruments ending up being classified as debts, and the consequences of that on balance sheet ratios, etc. There was a lot of requests for additional information. As I mentioned before, we are going to be looking at different ways of providing information. People talking about the effects of dilution, strike prices, terms, different ways of presenting the capital structure of an entity to allow users to better understand the risks and types of instruments, and what effects the different types of instruments have on the cost of capital, because the different characteristics can have very different effects. There was also comments made about the consequences of changing the distinction, because it's such a fundamental distinction that any change will have quite a big effect on the balance sheet, the profit or loss, and for the board to be aware about the impact of that change with respect to things like covenants, capital regulations, etc.
Okay, should we go straight to Peter and summarise the other group, and then we can open it up for discussion?
Yeah, I'd say we had a similar discussion as well, and in fact at one stage I thought we were heading for consensus, but then it seemed like there was a bit less consensus.
Thank God.
So maybe if I take the two instruments first of all, so the share settled debts, and I think that quite a few people in the group felt that it was best to classify those as debt rather than equity. But then there are others who felt that the fact that there was going to be no requirement to pay cash was also important. I think the people who favoured classifying that as a debt felt that the settlement, the liquidity factor could be covered by disclosure rather than through the classification. On the putable instruments, I think most people wanted to classify those as liabilities. but there were concerns about how to deal with the changes in value, and I think most people were uncomfortable with having those changes go through profit or loss. So a suggestion was that maybe we should use OCI for the changes in value of those types of equitable instruments. One notion that came up was that equity really ought to have some sort of permanence about it, and then if it wasn't going to be there permanently, maybe it shouldn't be equity. We had a discussion as well about whether voting was important. So people talked about situations where there is a class of voting shares and another class of voting shares, but that they have equal dividend rights. And I think most people seem to feel that probably whether the voting rights shouldn't really play any role in the classification. So as I said, in terms of liquidity, it's felt that the liquidity was certainly important. If that wasn't a factor in the classification, then it ought to be covered by the disclosures. Another disclosure theme that came up was about potential dilution and people wanting disclosure about that, possibly better disclosure than they get today. And I think we have to recognise that each of the three approaches here won't give you all the information that people need about possible dilution, so that would need to be covered in disclosure anyway. And I guess the final theme was this is a context area, do whatever we can to try and keep it simple.
Okay, let's open up for discussion. I didn't hear too many people supporting the value approach. So maybe if there's anybody that passionately believes that that is the right answer, now is an opportunity to speak. And people from the other two groups that did OCI, if you want to make any comments. Robert?
I actually am in the other group, but I'll make some comments. I'm historically a narrow equity person, but I think looking through the proposals, I don't care about settlement, because I view those as somebody pointed out, those are two transactions, and ultimately it doesn't matter whether you buy the shares, sell. The value had a lot of, I looked at the value and actually thought that it had a lot of conceptually, or it had some interest, because that's sort of what we're trying to capture. And particularly in the examples that we were shown, the value would give you I think, a good. Mark's not going to agree with me. I think it had conceptually some appeal. Then the reason I don't want value as a practical one, you gave us two very simple structures. None of these structures are as pure, and when it starts getting, I'll use the term hairy, I would have rather, because I suspect that when it begins to get hairy, I'd like there to be a clear distinction. I don't like the noise of it going back and forth based upon the details of the deal or the details of the structure. And so from a practicality point of view, sort of understanding where things would be, that's why I settled in on the narrow equity approach.
So I just want to raise a question quite sort of fundamentally. Is there any discussion in the two groups that in the case of liquidation where these claims would sit? In other words, if it's going to be classified as a liability, that tends to suggest that you have some claim over and above equity holders. So I'm just wondering whether or not that came into it, any of it, all the discussion of whether that's a relevant way to try and think about how these claims might be considered as either a liability or an equity.
Okay, do you come into the one that I was part of? Is that something you think we should really be focusing on?
Well, it's interesting, isn't it? Because if you think about company in liquidation and claims settled with shares, does the entity that has the claim in shares, will they get any special treatment or treatment over and above the ordinary equity holders?
I tend to agree with that. I think as an investor, when you look at your recovery values in a wider situation, where it sits in the capital structure, governs your view on what the price should be for that security relative to the other instruments in the capital structure.
Okay, Martin.
Yeah, if think one of the comments from the group, I fully agree with this, that for the share-based, the share-settled liabilities, that the main informative element is the dilution effect, and not so much the value. The value you would, as an investor, you would like to know, post-settlement, do I still own 70% of the original 100% of the company? What is the dilution? I think somehow dilution and shares outstanding, how it's calculated, is not as well as it could at the moment disclosed by many companies. And it deserves a little bit more attention. It could deserve a little bit more attention. And because it's how much do I own of the company as an investor? So it's something that that could have a little bit more attention. And so I actually agree with the results from the group.
If I look at how I treat these instruments when I do evaluation, whether they are debt-like equity or equity-like debt, I separate them and deduct them from the enterprise value. And when I do that, I like to have the market value. So consequently, what I would prefer is to have them bundled together under a certain line called hybrid capital, because that would make it easier for me to get hold of them. I'm not so keen of having to go through all the lines in the balance sheet just to figure out which they are, actually. So I would like to have them separate.
I think if you're doing an enterprise value type approach, then it becomes much less of a problem because these are just claims, and all the claims, you just have to identify their characteristics, and it doesn't quite matter whether it's debt or equity. But
no.
In terms of net income, which we know is a key measure, it really does matter. So there are all the others that would attach a much greater importance to this.
But also from that respect, if you can see in the balance sheet that this company has a certain, sorry, I get so nervous when I speak. If you can see it very clearly, you are aware of that the net income figure is distorted probably in some way. But if it is included and you do certain revaluations of it and stuff, the risk is actually that you actually don't see it.
So you'd be comfortable with the remeasurement of the puttable going through the income statement?
I will not answer that question. I always, when you put those questions, I need to think it
because the preparers in my group, that's where they fell off, and that presented difficulties, and then we talked about OCI and other things.
Perhaps as a general measure, analysts would favor choices that deliver relevant information in the income statement as a guideline for building rules. But in this case, perhaps a starting point should be a little bit different, because to be very basic, the only place where an analyst look at in the balance sheet is equity versus debt. So perhaps in this case, we should have a starting point which is balance sheet oriented, and not focusing too much on the income statement. It's a suggestion. I don't know the definitive answer, but I think here it is clearly a key point for what is a balance sheet, at least for a basic user.
I mean, you know that if it's a hybrid, there's an impact on the P&L in terms of the interest costs being lower than they otherwise would be because of the option value. So there is some intuitive value in sort of doing the remeasurements, but it just sounds so complicated. I should point out that actually in our group, the majority was in favour of the residual approach, certainly amongst the users, but there was an interesting distinction. The two preparers said different things, and it might be interesting to hear from them. Russell and Olivia said about that.
Any of the preparers like to wade into this discussion? It has been the users so far, isn't it, that predominated this one?
to hear from Russell. Does Russell want to?
Yeah, sure. I tend to think of the residual approach. GE has a pretty simple structure, but the common shareholder. I was referring to page 2 of 3 of the cover memo. Couldn't help but notice that when we define share settled debt and putable shares, that we start out with the definition with an obligation. So, I tend to think of them as debt. My experience has been, I'm troubled by the complexity of making a distinction under U.S. GAAP today. It's really difficult to apply the literature, and it's particularly the hybrid instruments coming up with assessing whether you've got a beneficial conversion feature. It just seems to add a lot of complexity. I think you can, maybe we would be transferring the complexity of making the distinction with measurement and the P&L. Maybe be careful what you ask for, but that's my reaction. I think we add a lot of complexity trying to make this distinction where the real value is probably in disclosure anyway. So that's where I am.
Yeah, the disclosure aspect was emphasized in the group that I made it as well.
I wouldn't undersell the value though of just the balance sheet recognition, because I know as analysts, you quickly run to the financial statements and you take what you have there and you make the business with ratios, whether it's anything from efficiency ratios, debt ratios, to the cash flow ratios.
Okay, should we move to your question?
Energy's narrow approach. Preferred shares would be classified as debt, right? Is that so? So what this makes sense to have preferred shares being classified as debt? It's pretty much happy to me.
Well, it would depend upon the terms of the preferred shares at the moment. Some are debt, some are equity.
So would the terms of the preferred shares suggest, because they are not the most residual class of shares?
Under the narrow equity approach, many things that currently are equity would move into debt, and that could include preference shares. Let's move on to OCI, shall we? The discussion of liabilities equity itself brought in OCI in places.
Just say a word about the previous subject, which is considering that the US GAAP are a settlement approach. But if we move to another approach, we will have a major topic on the different way to consider groups. And I don't think it's only something neutral, it's something that is major, because it has an impact on covenants and on the condition of the debt and equity.
Any move away from what we have in IAS 32 is going to be a big change. And that's why we're starting this project tentatively, and we will be very conscious of that. And yes, there could be a radical approach to this, and the narrow equity approach would be pretty radical. Obviously, we've talked about just 2 instruments here. When you get into all the derivatives on equity, it could have big changes. So we're very conscious of that. But we don't want to limit ourselves, say, well, we're just going to tinker with IAS 32 to solve some of the practice issues. We need to think about it holistically, and that's what we're trying to do. Okay, we're well aware of the complexity issue.
Perhaps Olivia was also saying, it would be great if one could get convergence between IESB in this area and other major standard setters. And, it would be very confusing if there was a different approach, say, in the US.
Just for clarity, I think convergence hurts the users more than it does the preparers. We have preparers talking about convergence. So
it hurts, I didn't quite understand.
The lack of comparability between standards probably, I would say, hurts users more than it hurts preparers. because at least you're preparing one state of financial statements in one, hopefully in one jurisdiction, hopefully.
Yeah, but you shouldn't ignore the fact that global companies, you know, there are times of pressures just to change standards just because of flexibility that one set of standards has compared to another. And that, I think, brings the whole standard setting process into disrepute. So you shouldn't ignore, I mean, there are many global companies that have the ability to, you know, really use US GAAP or not, so.
Okay, let's move on to OCI.
Shall we?
So, in our group, I suppose the key messages well, first of all, there was some desire that it would be nice to have it would be nice to define profit loss and OCI, but also recognition that it could be quite challenging or maybe even possible. I think where we had a consensus was that OCI should be used for evaluations, and then we had some discussion around is this all evaluations or some evaluations.
Revaluations,
yes. And so suggestions made included, let's look at what's outside management control, let's look at business model, let's look at the sort of timing, short-term versus long-term nature. But whereas those suggestions were made, there was no consensus either. Some people liked business model, some didn't, some liked management control, and some didn't. We didn't really have a chance to talk about recycling, but those who did make comments about recycling supported recycling of items that are included in OCI. I think these are probably key messages. I suppose one final observation from the user perspective is that it's very important to ensure consistent application of whatever the requirements are.
Okay.
We had a small group, so there was we got more people discussing this issue. Everybody in my group agreed with the rebuttable presumption that items in income and expenses should be included in profit and loss as a starting point, because that is relevant information. However, there were different views on where relevance should be and what it should be meant. Some users thought that what relevance is should be determined on a standard by standard basis, and the owners should be on the board to determine relevance. However, there were some others in my group thought that the conceptual framework should give some boundaries on what they mean by relevance, and they acknowledge that this could potentially have some exceptions in standards level, but that was the way. In terms of recycling, the users in my group they didn't think that all items should always be recycled, because they acknowledged that sometimes some items would unwind naturally through the input. Wouldn't recycle but unwind naturally because some things are out of OCI. Because they viewed that, and those users in my group thought that not recycling all the time is because they would know what is relevant and what's not when they determine their own information or when they do their own analysis. The preparers in my group all preferred always recycling. One was of the view that they should always recycle because they viewed that all total profits and loss for the entire life of the entity should equal the total cash flows of the entire life of the entity. Another preparer was of the view that they should always recycle when items are realized. So you might please add if I have missed something.
I think just the one other emphasis was that our starting point was very, very clear and consistent right across the group, and that was that the profit and loss should be the key performance measure of the entity, and therefore anything that was going to go through profit and loss had to actually, I think, support that fundamental view. and therefore anything that was going to go through OCI would only be allowed on the basis that it did not reflect the performance of the underlying entity. So that was our sort of starting point as a group, which was very consistently held.
I think that's consistent with the board's view at the last meeting. Does the board need to define performance to implement that approach?
In the conceptual framework?
Somewhere.
I think that would be very difficult to lay down a clear definition of performance that will be very useful for any standard you're going to set in the future. I think it is going to be too difficult. I think it will be very difficult to find. And actually, if you do, you probably base it on current experience, and it may be harmful in applying the use of OCI when you do need it. So I think there should be some discretion to the board to make use of OCI when setting future standards. And I'm not sure if all those circumstances can be defined in the conceptual framework. I think it's too difficult.
Okay. Malcolm, do you want to go next? Ian, do you want to come over and use the mic?
No, just very briefly, in answer to your question, I think the group focused more on the board giving more guidance on relevance. So we say it shouldn't be in profit and loss if it's not relevant. So it's kind of defining profit and loss in the roundabout way.
Okay, profit and loss is linked to relevance. Okay, Malcolm.
I echo what people have said, that the board is now accepting that sort of profit and loss, the normal net income, is the key KPI of performance. I think from the preparer side, I think we all welcome that. Personally, on the recycling, I feel that everything should be recycled. You could say that certain things, potentially, when you think of actuarial gains and losses, perhaps will only end up being recycled at the time of liquidation of the company, but so it might be very, very long term. But even so, I think as a principle, you could still say that everything should be recycled. And then, as regards the relevance point, I mean, I think when I view these recycling items, typically they don't relate to the period that we're talking about. So, I mean, I think the P&L. The concept of performance, I think, has a lot to do with performance in a period. And if you end up recycling something that ends up not being related to that period, then I think it requires separate disclosure. But I still feel you can put that in the normal income statement with adequate disclosure, either as a one-line item, or if you have to allocate it to the captions in the income statement with appropriate disclosure that stuff is being included in those lines that doesn't really relate to the period under review. So I think disclosure can get you a long way with the, we're dealing with the recycling issue.
Okay, starts in the corner over here, shall we check?
I was part of the group on performance reporting that started 10 years ago, 60 minutes. So I have heard a lot about that. I think that we have here two improvements. The first one is we finally agree that there are no one single figure, let's say comprehensive income, that tends to capture everything and then just choose whatever you want. I think it's accepting the fact that net income is something users want. It's a good starting point, as simple as that. It's not perfect, but it's the necessary one. So that's a big improvement, I think, in this 10-year debate. A second point is also admitting that there is no single principle to define OCI. If we accept them, I think this is a big improvement. We have to understand that we have limits in the way we make concepts, and we won't find any concept that will capture everything. This is a big improvement. So it seems to recognize that we might do it case by case, and that's I think a real improvement. Nevertheless, the board has to be, I think, cautious when making this assessment. It's a tough thing. It will be in difficult cases because all the existing OCI are not simple cases, are in fact difficult cases. So which should be the good guidelines, I think, for that? I have no precise idea yet, but nevertheless, I think we are going in a very good direction in improving the whole thing. And I would recommend that we never try again to find a single concept to capture editing, because we will be in case that are at the limit, at the edge of something, and we will have to make compromise and compromise our OCIs.
Okay, your time.
Yes, you know that this discussion came, you know, peer really is a prime management indicator. I think that's a very, very good movement, which I totally support. And we discussed in a group that, however, that shouldn't limit the usage of OCI, because normally, you know, when the P&L is a prime indicator, we have to keep the relevancy of that. That other side of the coin, that the OCI usage, you know, have not, you know, shouldn't be limited, so that relevancy of P&L, you know, should be always kept. So, you know, currently in this discussion paper, main usage of, you know, OCI, you know, basically imply that different measurement of P&L on the balance sheet. But there are, you know, some other instances which you are currently trying to define. But I think, you know, that, you know, sort of boundary or sub-concept, you know, should be brought in so that the usage of OCI should not be limited.
I agree with much of what's been said. Just a couple of things. One is on OCI, which is, I think the mismatches is the easiest to cope with. With bridging, I think that ideally you would not have different treatment in the P&L and in the balance sheet. And I think that you know, the accounting should be, it should be agreed what the right accounting is. So with the IFRS 9, is it hold or collect, or might they sell these financial instruments? You know, surely, you know, could you not have decided whether how they're going to be treated? And I think that's a bit of a danger that it's a sort of don't worry your little heads about some sort of a quite important balance sheet issue if it's sort of put in this OCI category, which we know you investors and users aren't going to really look at anyway. So that's my reservation about bridging. On transitory, which I think works brilliantly for pension funds, but again, the caveat is it's going to be hugely tempting to extend that to other things, obviously. So that's two things. The other thing is this whole thing, like with the IAS 1 discussion we'll have later, feels like the donut we're discussing around the edges. And both your comments and the early one about what the group was talking about revaluation is that what's really difficult is within the P&L, what are we doing with revaluation and comparing operating performance with remeasurements. And Jacques, Steve, you're veterans of the financial statement presentation project. You made loads of progress. You know, what's happening with it?
Well, we can have an update on that when we come to the disclosure initiative. Christy will say something about that. Peter, I think you're going
to. The key issue from my perspective is actually not OCI, but value changes. They are problems, whether we include them in the books or not. We like to get hold of them. Today, we include more and more of them. So then it becomes an accounting problem. And to me, it's quite obvious to collect this kind of very similar accounting problem under the same section in the income statement is useful. And also compared to putting them in the P&L on different lines. If you have the OCI, you also have it in the quarter reports. So it's also very easy to get hold of the revaluations that the company has made over a quarter. Because it is important when I try to estimate the coming quarter or the coming year normally, revaluations are very important. Because if I don't get hold of them, I will not come as close as the true answer the company will present later on. So the key issue is value changes, and I think all value changes should be included in OCI. That would make my day as an analyst easier. Also, real estate, forest, and IS 4041.
All value changes?
All value changes. I'm very like an Ayatollah in this.
Goodwill impairment.
No, good impairment is not a value change. That is a value decline. A value change goes both up and down. Now it's from an analyst, an estimation perspective, it is the volatility in the number that makes it difficult for me. A depreciation is not a difficult item, although it is kind of
an... You're saying all value changes should go through OCI?
Through OCI and be recycled.
Sounds like the matrix.
Sounds like
the matrix. We built 10 years ago.
With respect, well, you can actually have another sort of impairment charge, which also goes through the income statement.
Yeah, but to
that,
me...
Peter, that is very dangerous. I gave once in a speech an example of a couple of big companies in the United States that went down as a result of the employee benefit schemes. And that had always been building up outside the P&L in OCI until it was too late and it was clear to everybody it couldn't be repaid and then they had to go into bankruptcy to get rid of them.
But was so that outside the income statement completely?
No, it was in OCI, but you know, the dividend distributions were probably based on the P&L and not on what was going on in OCI. So it is very dangerous.
No, but I don't think it's dangerous. If you have the number, if you disregard it, it's up to you. But if you have the number,
but
I cannot really understand that. That's dangerous.
I mean, that's what I think is the value of the decisions that we've taken this far, and many seem to underline that. If you really think the P&L is the key performance indicator, well, I think even if we would decide, in the past 10 years, the board pretended that was not the case and that there was no clear hierarchy between the P&L and OCI. In the meantime, most of the markets, perhaps not the sophisticated investors like yourself, but most of the markets focus on the P&L as the key performance indicator and find OCI very difficult to understand. So accidents like this could happen, and I think that the decisions that were taken now to say P&L is the key performance indicator, well, if we are sure about that, that means that the threshold for OCI should be very high. I believe those are two very important decisions, and I'm glad that was recognized by at least some here.
I think that is a prudent approach, because if you assume that investors don't look at OCI, you need to bear in mind that this has been in place since 2009. We need to educate everyone what's included, and last year we included even more, so it became a little bit more difficult. So this is a learning phase. I'm sure that 10 years from now, analysts will look at OCI. If it stays like it is today, we will look at OCI the same way as we look at the other numbers, but not when we collect, for instance, estimates from analysts and put them together. We don't want revaluations included, for instance.
So let's move on to Hiroshi Tanya, then we'll move on after that. Hiroshi?
I think this proposed approach improved from the approach compared with the approach of discussion paper. And I have two comments. Regarding the profit and loss, it is a little complicated considering the paragraph 15 of Addendum Paper 2b. It shows four characteristics of profit or loss that should always go to profit and loss. But I'm not sure that whether you cover all aspects. Is that inclusive or not? I'm not sure. And these are too specific from the perspective of conceptual framework. The second point is regarding the recycling. I don't support the approach of recycling that is only for it is relevant. I support the full recycling approach, because that if there are some items that are not recycled, important information is missing from profit or loss. So I think you should focus on the timing of recycling rather than the relevance.
So I thought, perhaps I don't like to disagree with another user, but I think very much as Hans has said, I think if we go back to the first principles that what goes through the P&L should be a reflection of the performance of a company, making essentially a bright line rule that all revaluations go through OCI, I think can be as dangerous as having everything forced into the P&L. And this is where you really do hope that the management of the company is going to be able to, I think, highlight or justify something that is relevant to the P&L. I think exactly as Hans was saying, when you have pension liabilities growing and growing and growing, if that was not at some point going to be recognised by management back through the P&L, then quite clearly someone who's looking at the P&L perhaps would get a misconception about the performance of the entity. So I think this is the idea of having this ability to discredit OCI and P&L and allow essentially that the concept to allow management to determine what is relevant to P&L, but with a very high standard to get into OCI.
Okay, Peter promises it's a very short response.
I'm in favour of 100% recycling, so it will eventually end up in P&L.
Okay,
it may be too late. And recycling is so open to earnings management.
No. How can you say that? I disagree.
I think I agree with, you know, the recycling idea and all this stuff, but the key thing, and I think Malcolm brought it up first, is like we measure performance for periods, and I think some of the dogma that I hear now might affect how relevant the number is to capture a period performance, and we shouldn't forget about those things. Well, because ultimately, we're trying to, you know, see how we can replicate those changes, etc., in models, right? So, you know, recycling, yes, but let's make sure that we understand what pertains to a period performance so that we can forecast period performance going forward.
Okay, interesting discussion on both OCI and liabilities equity. Thank you all for that. Didn't detect too much opposition to what we're proposing to do on OCI. Discussion around the edges, but it does seem that many of you are pretty supportive of at least the direction that we're going in.
Yeah, I find that because when we received all the letters, in the comment letters, that didn't seem to be the understanding of the significance of what he has proposed in the discussion paper. And I feel you understand much better that came through in the comment letters. So I find it very, very important. We are on the right track.
Okay, let's move on, shall we? And Michelle and Christy, go around. Russell, you've dropped off mute. We can hear you typing. That's fine. And do shout out if you want to get into the conversation. And for you as well, Gora.
By the way, can you still see me? I can't.
Yeah, we can see you. You dropped off occasionally.
Okay, all right.
Goro, my friend, we can't see you. So if you want to get in, shout out. Oh, we can't see you. Okay,
yeah,
when you speak, you flip over. That's good.
I couldn't see, but now that the image was recovered, so I can see you now.
Excellent.
And I can hear you very clearly.
Good, and we can see you as well.